Hello and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Samsung again. We can't stop talking about this company. I wonder why. Might be big or something. They've got three phones, the Galaxy A52, the A72, and the A52 5G. We also have the next developer preview of Android 12 to talk about. Not a ton to talk about, but we'll get into it. Google has done the thing. They have dropped commissions for developers who earn $1 million of revenue on the Play Store down to 15%. It's the thing that Apple did. Google has followed suit. Some developers not so happy about this. Others are very happy. Google is getting sued again for something different this time. This lawsuit does not seem to have legs, though. We'll get into why that is. And we'll talk about a new Nest Hub that got announced this week. It is the second gen, and it's got the Solis. I don't know why, but maybe Jerry can explain. All right. We will start with Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm coffeed up. I'm ready to go. Harish John Legata, all the way from the nighttime. I'm sorry to make you pot on a Friday night again, buddy. How are you?
Hello. All good. Yeah. I mean, night doesn't mean anything anymore. I'm reviewing so many phones, I've lost all sense of time.
Fair enough. I appreciate your commitment nonetheless. And R. Wagner, how's Disney World?
I haven't been this week. It's so freaking crowded. Like, I went on Sunday? Yeah, Sunday I went and did a couple of laps around Epcot in the evening, but I couldn't get into the parks this week. I have a pass for Animal Kingdom tomorrow. I'm not sure how long I'm going to stay because this week is spring break for Florida and spring break for Texas, two states that have had no problems with people traveling for vacations, apparently. So it's been super, super crowded. I'm not happy about it.
Yeah, I love the shade. I love the shade. It's like, tourists, get the hell out of here. But I want a mask
up. I live here and I wear a mask properly. And apparently, tourists can't do that.
So they don't enforce the proper mask wearing?
Girl. They try.
They don't have Goofy going around and like poking people in the nose when their noses are exposed?
I mean, I wish Cinderella, I could get them to
kicking guys in the balls when they're not wearing a mask.
They basically have the mask police, but it's mostly people being like, "Hey, you can't walk around and eat, or please, you need to pull your mask needs to cover your nose too." But the second that those cast members walk away, most people just go right back to what they were doing.
Oh dear. Well,
it's like the hall monitor in high school. It's okay. I'm wearing my hat. The vice principal is coming. I'm just going to take off the hat, and as soon as they turn the corner, it goes back on. Except instead of it being a fashion statement, it's, you know, people's health and safety.
Yeah. Well, wear a mask is the conclusion here. Let's get into some Android news. So this week was an Unpacked event, Harish. I don't know why the company decided to hold an Unpacked for the A series, but increasingly the A series is an important brand for the company. Last year, the A51 was the best-selling phone in the world outside of the iPhone 11. It wasn't a good phone, but it was a very sold in numbers. So let's go through the ones that Samsung announced. They also have already announced the A32, which you reviewed already on the site. So maybe give us the lay of the land for the two series, the A32, A52, A72, and a rumored A82 that's supposed to be coming out later this year.
Okay. The A series has been a bestseller for Samsung, primarily outside North America for a while, just because it has been able to successfully bring some of the features from its flagship Galaxy S series and retain some of those design elements as well. So it was able to bring in customers very well and also offer a device series that had a lot of premium features, but was affordable. And with the 32 and A52 and A72, it's rolling out a lot of interesting upgrades actually this year. The A51 was not a good phone last year. I did not like using that at all. It was laggy just in terms of general browsing. I mean, I couldn't scroll through Twitter without the phone slowing down. So they fixed all of those problems this year. The A32 is powered by the Helio G80. it's not as fast as something that I would have liked to see in this category, but it's still better than last year. But the A52 and the A72 are powered by the Snapdragon 720G. Now, this is much better than what we got last year. Last year, it was the Exynos 9611, and that was using really old Cortex A73 cores, and it just wasn't good. So in that context, from a performance point of view, they're already much better than last year. The only difference between the A52 and the A72 is that the A72 has a larger 6.7-inch screen and a larger 5,000 mAh battery. But otherwise, the specifications are the same across the two devices. So what's new is a 90Hz refresh rate for the panels. All three phones actually use Super AMOLED displays, but they now have 90Hz refresh as standard. And there's also a variant of the A52 that has 5G connectivity, and that one has 120Hz refresh rate because Samsung needs to differentiate that somehow other than 5G. And other than the performance and the refresh rate, there's a 64MP camera at the back as standard, and it has optical image stabilization, and it is better than the 48MP sensors they've used here last year, because the camera last year did not hold up well in low light situations, and that thankfully is not a problem now. So I'm glad that they upgraded the cameras as well, and this 25-watt fast charging, although the charger in the box is still a 15-watt charger because Samsung.
Because Samsung, and that's a theme. So we're going to say because Samsung a bunch of times here, because there was the A51 and then the A71. The A51 shipped with that underpowered Exynos chip that everybody hated, the reason it was slow. The A71 shipped with a more powerful Snapdragon 730, which was still a 4G only chip, but it's good. It's the same one that's in the Pixel 4a. It got the job done, especially on a 60Hz display, 6 gigs of RAM, etc. Later in 2020, though, Samsung released 5G versions of the A51 and A71. There were two A51 5G versions. One that was released to T-Mobile and AT&T that used an Exynos 980. So it actually had an Exynos chip in the U.S. that did non-millimeter wave 5G, so sub-6 5G. And it was a great chip. It did the job. And then there was the UW version released exclusively on Verizon that actually stepped it up to a Snapdragon 765G, which is the same 5G chip found in basically every other mid-range phone last year. Now we have a weird situation where they've sort of reverted to cheaper SoCs as a way to save a bit of money. So the A51 and A52 and A72, as you mentioned, are Snapdragon 720 series platforms, and the A52 5G is a 750G, which we haven't really seen much of. Talk us through those decisions, especially since in some cases it's going to be a pretty sizable backslide in terms of performance with a 90Hz and 120Hz display. You generally need more processing power.
Yeah. So with the A52, it's gains all around because the 720G is just generally better than what we got last year, just in terms of everyday browsing as well as gaming as well. The Adreno 618 GPU holds up really well for most casual games. It struggles a bit for intensive games like PUBG or Call of Duty Mobile, but for regular day-to-day use, it is much better than the Exynos 9611. For the A72, I was also under the impression initially that it was a downgrade in terms of the chipset itself, but in my usage, I've used it alongside other Snapdragon 730 and 732G phones. It's on par, actually. And then I dug into some of the synthetic benchmark scores, and it turns out that the Snapdragon 720G actually hits the sweet spot for performance. It is just as fast in single core scores as the Snapdragon 730 and 732G. And it is actually faster in a few gaming scenarios because the Adreno 618 here is clocked higher than the Snapdragon 730G last year. So it's able to deliver just that little bit better performance. We're talking very little difference here, maybe about 3-5%. Increase over the 730 and about the same percent decrease over the 732G. So in terms of where it slots in, it's actually better than the 730G and slightly not as good. I mean, slightly decreased performance than the 732G. So I don't understand Qualcomm's naming convention here, because in terms of performance, it's actually really good. And the fact that Samsung was able to save some cash by going with this is a win, because we're at least getting good performance and they're able to retain that value somehow.
Okay, so we don't have pricing yet, but assuming they are similarly priced to last year, we're looking at around a $350 to $400 price tag for the A52. A52 5G might be a little bit more. Similarly, the A7. So we know a couple of things. We know that the A52 5G will be the one coming to North America. We don't have any word on A72 5G yet, but I'd imagine it's either in the works or it'll be announced later this year. What do we know about the A82? Because that's a follow-up to the flippy double camera thing that happened a couple of years ago with the A80.
It is interesting because the A80 did not get a wide release, primarily because I'm assuming the camera module was difficult to manufacture at scale. So it'll be interesting to see just how many markets the phone is released in. I'd imagine it'll be the same sort of limited markets that the A80 launched in. But I'm more interested in the 5G versions this year, because they're going with the Snapdragon 750G, and that is a very capable chipset. I used it on the Xiaomi Mi 10T Lite, which launched as the Mi 10i in India. And it is actually on par with the 765G. It's slightly lower underclocked. So because Qualcomm, again, likes to maintain that level of differentiation. But other than that, it's actually a really good chipset. And I'm glad that Samsung is going with the Snapdragon variant as standard for the 5G version, because as good as the Exynos 980 was last year, I think the Snapdragon mid-range chipsets still have an edge in this particular regard.
All right, let's move on to talking about some broader industry shortages and issues with chipsets. So we talk a lot about Qualcomm. Qualcomm has mentioned that the chip shortage that's affecting all semiconductor businesses will affect them as well. Samsung has come out and basically said that the chip shortage will affect its bottom line this year. It's not going to launch a new Galaxy Note but it will launch another one next year, which is kind of interesting. We knew that already. We knew that there wouldn't be a Galaxy Note in 2021. In fact, somebody called out a comment that I was saying last year, right before the Note 20 series launched, about how it's very unlikely Samsung would call the S21, the S30, the S21. I ended up having to eat my words there. But we knew a lot about what was happening with the S21 series, including the Ultra that would support the S Pen, and the rumors that Samsung would not launch a Note series phone this year, even well before the shortage was mainstream news. So what do we know about that now, Jerry? What's the impact on the semiconductor parts shortage, and will it affect the ability for you or I to go to a store or go online and buy a phone? Or is this mainly talking about just the sheer volume of chips aren't going to be available?
You're going to be able to go and buy a phone, but maybe not the phone you wanted to buy. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Samsung says that the chip shortage is the reason it's not going to bring out a Galaxy Note, and then reminds us how the S21 Ultra is a fine replacement. You know, it's hard to argue their logic there. If they can't make it, they can't make it. But they're smart enough to hold back chips for the phones that are selling. They want you to be able to go buy a Galaxy S21 Plus around Black Friday, because it's going to be really good price. It's going to be amazingly fast. It's a great phone, and everybody knows it's a great phone already. And that they want to make those available at a good price,
right?
And that's even Apple has announced that the chip shortage is going to affect them, and that's, you know, crazy. They don't build their own chips; they design them, and the same factory that builds other chips builds them. So that's where the shortage is, and it's not just phones. If they're having a hard time keeping up production on, you know, semiconductors in general, it's your you know, Wi-Fi router has a semiconductor chip inside it, for lack of a better word. It's like a processor combination, pretty much like a phone has. So this is an industry issue, and I do think that the priorities are in order, and most companies are going to, you know, follow along what Samsung is doing. Apple, of course, they're Apple. They're just going to slow production down and meter them out. But if you wanted a phone, you'll be able to buy one. And I'm just kind of rambling here because it's hard to say that, you know, with any other words, that their phones will be there, but they're going to have to choose to make the right phone.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Samsung is saying, they said publicly last week that certain SoCs, certain systems on a chip will be at their regular capacity. Higher end Qualcomm chips are sort of the ones that they're able to produce at scale. It's the mid-range ones that Qualcomm's having an issue with. The yeah. irony here is that Samsung is the fab for a lot of Qualcomm yeah. SoCs. So Samsung yeah. is in a position where its own manufacturing capabilities have affected Qualcomm's ability to supply Samsung electronics with parts for its devices. So demand for mid-range phones is higher because of price sensitivity in the market. Samsung is obviously going after that mid-range aggressively, but may end up not being able to supply the demand for those devices and may end up having to right. lower the cost of its higher-end devices to meet the demand of Samsung customers. So we've seen this already with the Snapdragon, with the S21. The S21 launched at $800. We've already seen discounts to $650 for the S21. I think it's even gone as low as $600, if I'm not mistaken. And
I think so.
The S21 Plus and S21 Ultra have also been discounted by more than $200 already just a couple of months after launch.
Yeah. And let's not forget, this isn't going to just affect your phones. This is going to make buying a laptop harder this year. This is going to make buying some cars harder this year.
Yeah. 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 Car manufacturers were the first companies to be impacted by this. Samsung says that it's going to be trying to keep up with demand for its laptops as well. And this, you know, Samsung is not a massive laptop maker compared to bigger companies like HP, Dell, Lenovo. So they're obviously going to have a much harder time. It'll be interesting to see whether Samsung can meet the demand for these A52 and A72 series devices, if only because they made such a big deal about the launch, and this is a very important segment for them. Let's talk a little bit about the second developer preview for Android 12. Jerry, we knew this was coming. It was basically a month after the first. Not a lot of massive changes here, but we have one more developer preview in April before we get the public beta in May. So give us the high-level rundown of the second developer preview and sort of where we're at in terms of the development.
It appears that Google's on track. There was no, you know, short list of big, huge problems that they had to face from the first preview. But the second preview is, think of it as like a refinement. The first developer preview went out there. Oh, it worked on the 100 phones we tested it on well enough to let other people test. That's what you have to remember. That's what this was. If you worked at Google, you probably have been testing it. But now let's let the public test it. And of course, a million bug reports start rolling in, and they all have to be fixed before you build on top of that. So that's what the second preview is. Hopefully, you know, they addressed what they really needed to address, because there are a lot of things that aren't quite finished that we may or may not see in Android 12. And that's always the case. We saw things in the Android 11 preview, if you dug in there and activated, that just never made it in. We want some of those, of course, to actually make it into Android 12. And that kind of requires things to go smoothly. because Google can't go back and break. Well, they shouldn't go back and break something that they had fixed, even though, you know, it's Google. They might do that after all. No big difference. It's still not a daily driver. My Pixel 4, I had to flash it 3 times before my battery would charge. That doesn't make any sense. I, you know, didn't even bother to file a bug report. I've never heard anybody with that kind of problem. But everybody, it seems, still has little problems. So I wouldn't say if you've only got one phone and it's a Pixel, don't rush out there to do it and, you know, just to get it right away. But if you are a developer and you, you know, want to check it out, it's definitely usable if you want to test the new APIs and stuff. And that's where Google wants it to be. The beta is different. The beta, it wants the public to see things, not just have them able to be turned on in the back. So we're all looking forward to the next, you know, preview to make sure everything's nice and smooth so they can add stuff, hopefully.
All right. There are a couple of major aesthetic changes and one feature change that I think I want you to weigh in on. The first is that the dark mode seems to be getting progressively lighter as we go on. This is the second change in a row where that happened. It's not light yet. I mean, people keep saying, like, if you want a light mode, just change it to light. This is dark gray as opposed to
AMOLED black. No, this is still a higher contrast for at night, but at the same time, why would you not just stick with AMOLED black? Like, have a toggle if you want it to be dark versus AMOLED black, but keep AMOLED black as an option.
I know
why. If it is not hex black, it is not a black theme. Please.
I know why. You ever see that on an LCD?
OLED, yeah. I know what you're talking about, Jerry. Yeah, and yeah, you it does can't make do scrolling.
But isn't so aren't they able to detect the screen that you're using?
I'm sure they can, but as a general, you know, just part of AOSP, what do we want dark to be? You can't have it all zeros, an absence of color, because an LCD can't display that. And it's this weird washed out gray and it makes the screen get all janky and foobar. I'm sure it can be detected and, you know, should be and give you that option. But that's probably why it's done.
Let's also be real. One of the big things that we were hoping was coming in DP2 that didn't was Monet, was the new theming system. And that is still buried underneath layers of flags and ADB commands. So you still have to dig to turn that on. And we were hoping that was going to be on DP2. So that way maybe it would be most of the big bugs would be ironed out with it before the beta in May. And I don't think that's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I don't think that's that big a deal until Android 12 actually comes out. I'm hoping this is something that Google will have ready for the final version. But right now, the people who would write any type of software that uses that theme engine, they're the people that can turn it on to test their ideas and be ready.
Yeah, but I want to be able to play with it on
Well, you can turn it on.
Yeah, you're a developer. You know how to flag.
Do it.
Just do it. Peer pressure.
Do it right now. Get the cable out.
I haven't flashed Android 12. I'm waiting for the beta because I like my Pixel.
Yeah, you're smart. You're smart. Yeah, I agree. So I just want to talk about the addition of this one-handed mode. We saw glimpses of it in DP1, but it's now a regular toggle. It works very similar to Apple's reachability. It's interesting that Google, after seeing years and years of Samsung and other manufacturers implement a literal just minimizing of the entire screen with, you know, Samsung's the most prominent one that uses this, but others as well. I think LG does too. They went with the reachability style where you swipe down on the gesture bar and it just lowers the top half of the display so that you can reach the notification shade. I don't like reachability on an iPhone. I far prefer the Android implementation that Samsung offers. Why do you think, Harish, that Google went with this particular implementation?
Yeah, I don't understand it either, because it's not just Samsung. Most Android manufacturers, if you look at Xiaomi, Oppo, Vivo, all of them follow a similar one-hand mode where the whole size of the screen is shrunk down. So it doesn't make much sense for Google to go against the, go against whatever is currently being standard, offered as standard. So I think this is one of those features that'll end up being canceled in the beta. So we'll have to wait a few more years for it to be finalized. And then once we get to a final version, it'll look similar to what we have with other manufacturer skins, similar to what we have with scrolling screenshots and the like. So at this point, I don't see it being as useful as Samsung's implementation. And
I can see it being useful in a couple of instances. And the first one being that for all the one-handed modes that just shrink the entire screen, that makes it harder to use for anybody who has like their font size turned up or their zoom size turned up. One-handed mode is absolutely useless for any of them. But with this, if it's just going to move everything down, everything will still be the same size. So it's better from an accessibility standpoint.
But I don't know. The only phones that I've used one-handed mode on are like really tall screens with 6.9-inch screens and 6.7-inch screens. And it just, for my use case, it's just easier to shrink the whole screen down so that I can access the notification pane and the toggles.
But this is one of those instances where Google is adding this to AOSP, that it is right. An API that Android makers can use. And as Harish mentioned, most Android makers already have their own implementation. So they may go ahead and just ignore this, and this will just be a Pixel-only feature, which makes sense because Pixels have not been massive phones, right? The Pixel 4 XL was the biggest phone that Google has ever released. Well, I guess the Nexus 6 was bigger, but that wasn't a Google phone. That was a Motorola abomination. But
Kaiju.
Hey, I like that phone.
It's true. It was enormous. But you know, if Google continues its trend of releasing relatively small premium or flagship phones, whatever you want to call them, this implementation of one-handed mode would make sense. And then Samsung can choose to use Google's API or to give users the ability to continue using its kind of fuller one-handed mode, which just minimizes the entire display to one corner or the other. I don't see a problem with that. I just find it interesting that Google seems to be going against the grain again and adding this particular feature to AOSP.
I think that Google just was mostly worried about putting something in there that works no matter what the phone is.
Right.
LG has their own implementation, but those $40 phones they make for carriers, this will just work. LG has to do nothing. And other companies, you know, these smaller brands, we all get emails pitching about, though maybe they don't have the best software engineers in the world, so this just works for them. I'm curious, I've never seen it. How does one-handed mode on a Galaxy Fold work?
I have no idea.
Could this be something useful for foldables?
Outside screen where it's super duper tall? Yeah, I could see that.
Well, or what if they can just like make a mixture of the two? Well, imagine if you have a fold and it's opened up and you turn on one-handed mode and it makes the keyboard down in the lower right, lower left, whatever corner, and scales it up so you can still use it, but doesn't change anything else. I just, something about this tells me that Google had foldables in mind.
Yeah, you're right. It could be, or it's, I think what Ara mentioned about it being just an accessibility feature rather than a user, like a consumer feature, I think makes a lot of sense, right? This is a easy to understand. It's not, there aren't a lot of toggles. You don't have to worry about what side of the screen this is going to hit. This is mainly for people who just want an easy way to pull down the notifications shade or reach the top of the screen. I could see a future where, you know, this is kind of my dream, where if you, depending on the direction that you swipe, so if you swipe straight down, it gives you this reachability, or if you swipe down and to the right, it pulls the whole screen down a la Samsung, or swipe down into the left a la Samsung as well. I think that would be great, and it would be pretty easy to differentiate between those gestures. but I don't know if that's something Google's going for. I think this is very much a simple is best approach from a UX perspective, and this is as simple as it gets. So,
but what you just said about the hybrid based on the gesture, wouldn't that be great on a Samsung phone?
Oh, totally.
What if Samsung added this to what they already have that works? So you could make that choice. I never thought of that.
Well, I know that Samsung's whole executive team listens to this podcast. So if you want a free idea, we're happy to give it to you.
Wait, I didn't say free.
I was going to say we deserve to have a couple of like samples.
Exactly. Well, we get a fair number of samples. I've got like 6 pairs of Galaxy Buds here, but that's mainly because That's mainly because they send them with every phone, and I don't.
You've even got Galaxy Buds in your cat's ears by now.
I do.
Everybody in your family.
I do. Yeah. All right. I want to talk a little bit about this Play Store commission decision. So as of June 1st, Google will follow Apple's example. Developers that earn up to $1 million in revenue will only pay a 15% cut to Google, after which they will pay a 30% cut. This is kind of like a tax the rich thing where if you're a massive company, you can take the 30% hit, which is what you've been paying since the inception of the Android market. If you are a smaller indie developer, you're getting a 15% break. Obviously, this is good news for smaller developers, but companies like Epic have come out to say that this is not the solution. This is just placating the people who are aggressively opposed to the way that the Play Store increasingly feels like a walled garden that does not allow companies like Epic to charge for to use its own payment processing within the app if it does not allow Google's processing as well. So Tim Sweeney said, it's scary for the tech industry to see that Google and Apple aligning their monopolistic policies in near lockstep. In a free app market, rates would be much lower for all due to competition and not subject to their divide and conquer tactics. Tim Sweeney forgets that the Galaxy Store exists and F-Droid exists and basically all these other third-party app stores exist as well on Android.
And he could build his own Epic App Store.
He has his own Epic App Store.
He has.
But he just chooses to ignore that fact when it's convenient to him.
That's why I said it that way. You know, that's a thing he could have done. Well, dummy.
Yeah.
I have no sympathy for him, but he is right that this is there to placate and keep Google from being forced to have a commission set by a bunch of socialist senators or whatever, you know, the money counters think. Google wants to still make a little bit of money, so this is going to try to keep them out of hot water. Same as Apple. They didn't do this because they like to give away money.
No, I mean, look, the argument there is that Google's got a less heavy hand over moderation in the Play Store, and maybe it should have reduced this to 15% across the board anyway, because the overhead costs of maintaining the Play Store feel like it's not as high as it is on the App Store, although the moderation policies on the App Store are so arbitrary at times where it's almost like they hire monkeys to do the moderation instead of people.
I was going to say, if they're going to take 30% commission, could they at least hire enough moderators to where complaints are handled in a timely manner by a human?
Yeah, and I mean, the App Store was just sued by a developer yesterday because this developer was complaining that there are so many subscription scams happening on the Play Store that kind of use the loopholes within the subscription system to make it easy for people to accidentally sign up. And then the developer has to essentially moderate all of the complaints when people have recurring bills that they didn't realize that they were signing up for. Not to mention the fact that there are just apps out there to scam you, that they're basically taking advantage of App Store SEO to show up early on in your search results. You download an app that seems like it's going to be what you want. You open it. It sort of manipulates you into signing up for a subscription that you didn't realize. And then a month later, you have this $10 or $100 recurring fee that you have to then cancel and get your money back. And these apps are scams. So it's not like they're going to give your money back and then you have to fight with Apple or your payment, like your credit card company. So it's just, it's a big deal. Google does not seem like it has that problem at scale, mainly because, I don't know, more apps are free or there just is a better subscription solution on the Play Store. But yeah, I mean, this overall, this just feels like a good thing for indie developers at a time when indie developers desperately need the revenue. So I'm gonna say this is a net positive.
I would like it to go one step further, and let's say the first 100,000 of revenue, Google doesn't take anything. They can afford that. They can easily afford that, and that encourages more independent development.
Sure.
True. And I like that this is focused towards indie developers, but what Google is doing differently is that this is a flat 15% cut, regardless of how much revenue you're making. So even if there's a bigger developer that makes like 10 million in revenue, the first million will still be 15% for them.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you're using anything other than Indeed for your hiring, you are wasting your time. Hire great people faster with Indeed. Only pay for the results and get back time in your schedule. Indeed.com is the hiring site that helps you find quality candidates with Indeed Instant Match. Indeed searches through the millions of resumes in their database to help show you great candidates instantly. Unlike some hiring sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a quality shortlist faster. With Indeed, there are no long-term contracts. You can pause your account at any time and only you pay for what you need. With Indeed Instant Match, you see a great list of candidates with zero wait. And Indeed delivers four times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to Talent Nest. Want your quality shortlist fast? You need Indeed.com. Right now, our listeners get a free $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/ACP. This is Indeed's best offer available anywhere. Get a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/ACP. And thank you, Indeed, for sponsoring the show. All right, I want to talk quickly about this Incognito lawsuit because it feels just completely insane. The lawsuit asserts that Google does not disclose that when you enter an incognito mode, it is giving you enough warning, even though it does. But Jerry, give us the high level explanation on what this lawsuit is about and what Google is going to do to defend itself or address the accusations.
In the Chrome browser, if you open up an incognito tab or a new incognito window, you don't go to your regular new tab or new window screen. You go to a warning screen that tells you what incognito mode does. And it does. It tells you exactly what it does and doesn't do. But apparently, it still had a group of people confused. And then they found out they were still getting, you know, data tracking from Google or from Facebook or any website they would visit. And they thought that they were being tricked, that, you know, incognito mode should be, you know, a private mode, and it's not. And this suit's been around for a while, but Google fought to have it dismissed. And just, you know, this, what was it, last week, the judge decided to let the lawsuit go forward. I've seen a couple people say that even the judge admitted that this lawsuit seems unwinnable. And it's that thing, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, you are told if you don't understand the language you're given, is that Google's fault? I don't think it's Google's fault, but I think they should have known. The past 5 years, we keep getting programmed not to trust Google, not to trust Facebook. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. Some things are, you know, blown way out of proportion. But Google knows these things are happening, and it should have had the foresight to reword that little warning to make it clear to everyone that, you know, companies that use advertising services and websites you visit, including Google, can still track your behavior. That would have prevented this completely. just that small wording change. And I think they should have known that.
I think there is just this stigma behind the term tracking, right? Google is so committed to maintain. These days, Google has this commitment to allowing users to oversee the privacy settings that a Google account allows you to tweak. But at the end of the day, when you are browsing regularly or in incognito mode on Google, even though in incognito mode, you're not necessarily signed in to your Google account. It's not like counting towards the sites that you visit. You're still interacting with the web, and the web has trackers, thousands of trackers that will put a name to you and your browsing behavior, even if it's not specifically logging your IP address or landing a cookie in your jar or whatever, or the next generation of cookies that you talked about a couple of weeks back, Jerry. The idea that without an explicit way to track you using cookies, these companies will have to devise a way to sort of assign an identity to you using metadata, which is sometimes even more difficult to block because it's sort of underneath the more exposed parts of the web.
Yep.
And I believe that Google the accusation here is that Google has not done enough to counter the narrative that incognito mode hides your identity from the internet, the way that a VPN does, or Ghostery, or ad block, or something that you can use within Chrome as a third party tool, and that's really what this comes down to. But
yeah, in case you are listening and weren't aware, all incognito mode does is doesn't locally keep a history file. You can still sign into Google and you can be tracked with your regular tracking ID, or you're still anonymously tracked if you visit a website, any website, including ours. I'll be up front here. Facebook hits you with a cookie. Facebook is everywhere. Google is everywhere. These companies are still there. It just doesn't prevent any of that, but Google doesn't claim it does.
Yeah. So the judge saying that this lawsuit is not winnable because Google has done a sufficient job disclosing what incognito mode does, but it could still do a hell of a lot better in terms of proactively educating users on what incognito mode doesn't do. And
see, I should have been a judge. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
I feel like you would actually be a really good judge, Jerry, because you're fair.
Judge Joe Brown.
You should have a television show on our YouTube channel.
You heard it. Samsung executives, since you listen, you can sponsor us.
Yeah, I'm sure they would love to sponsor. They would love to put their brand in front of Judge Jerry and all of Jerry's swear words. That's definitely wholesome.
I almost said one. Did you notice that? Yeah. Okay, this is going to happen, guys. If you got a case you want to bring to Judge Jerry, just hit me up.
All right, I want to run through the last couple. This week, Google launched its second generation Nest Hub. It's not a big deal, really, in the scheme of things. It looks identical. It's the same size. The internals are miniaturized so that there is a wider, a bigger port, bigger passive radiator to increase bass response by 50%, according to Google. I haven't heard it yet. I'll be reviewing it in the next week or two. But it also has a feature that we saw on the Pixel 4 series. It's a solely radar sensor. It is used specifically to track your sleep, which is something that nobody really thought you would want to do with a device next to your head. But Jerry, it's doing this in a pretty innovative way. It's doing it all on device, so there's no personal health data going over the internet to Google servers. It is not using this data to advertise to you. So from a privacy perspective, I don't think we need to go too much into it. But from a tech perspective, this is quite interesting. So give us the quick rundown of how it works.
Soli is basically weather radar. If you've watched your local news or seen it online, rain shows up as a blob. As it moves, it's tracked the way it moved. It moves. But Soli, the the thing that it's a combination of seeing and hearing. It's radar. The scope is very narrow. It's looking for tiny, minute movements. That's helpful for this. It can see the second gen hub. I've been reading on how it works. It sees movements in your chest as you're breathing. It sees movements in your legs. It sees how still or not still your body is. And then the microphone also picks up your breathing, picks up ambient sounds, and the light sensor picks up, you know, light data from the room. And this all goes into Google Fit, and it can help you analyze your sleep and things you could do to maybe sleep better. And the coolest part is you don't have to wear anything. It doesn't use any type of motion sensor. It just keeps hitting that little radar pulse out, and it gets the data back, and it can see that you moved. And they say it's a sub-millimeter movement that it can detect. So that's very, very tiny. I mean, all our Canadian friends know when you say smaller than a millimeter that it's not much. If you're an American, that's, you know, real little. That's a good way to describe it. Real little. So I think it's innovative and it's cool. I still don't think this is the potential for Soli, you know, that we all wanted to see. I know I'm definitely still a little disappointed in what they've done with it, but it is cool. I like the fact that they took the camera out and added this.
Oh, there's no camera in the 7-inch model.
Right.
So it was just in the Max.
Yeah. I wish they offered one with both the camera and Soli. You know, people like having a camera. I personally have tape over the camera in my, because it's in my bedroom. I don't want a camera in my bedroom. So I like the fact that it doesn't have the camera, but I know some people would want it and still want to be able to use the sleep tracking. I'm really thinking about ordering one. I'm an insomniac, and wearables don't work because even when I'm asleep, I toss and turn. So, you know, sometimes it says I didn't sleep at all, and I know I slept. So maybe this will do better. We'll have to see.
So one interesting aspect of this is sleep tracking will be a premium feature starting in 2022, which means that it'll likely be tied with some sort of a Google Fit or Fitbit premium account. So we're not really sure what form that's going to take because Google and Fitbit are still integrating. But in the press release, they did say in the fine print that it's a preview, a free preview of the sleep tracking feature throughout 2021. So by the time 2022 comes around, we'll have a bit more detail about how Google plans to monetize this. And I'm hoping they will add features as they decide to start charging for it. But it is fascinating how Google is trying to use this Fitbit acquisition to make some money, obviously, besides hardware. And Fitbit was already moving in the direction of monetizing through software anyway with Fitbit Premium, adding a lot of features to that monthly bill. So that seems to be working pretty well. I wouldn't say Fitbit Premium is a massive success, but it's certainly better than the tiny margins that the company was able to charge on its wearables. So I'm excited for this, and I think that what we're seeing is that Google used the Pixel 4 as an experiment vector for Soli. It failed miserably, and they are pivoting. But what happened was they basically left a generation of phone buyers with a pretty unusable feature that didn't really do much, and that left a sour taste in people's mouth. So Google has to do a lot more to, I think, prove the efficacy of Soli in the long term.
I want Soli in my Nest Hub to act as a remote control. Damn it. It's tied to, you know, my Android TV. It's tied to my smart lights. I want to be able to take and do the little motion with my fingers and turn the sound up on the television when I'm casting a movie to Netflix. Damn it. You put the chip in the damn thing that you advertise as being able to sit in your living room and be an integral part of your smart home. Make it do something. Just sleep tracking is cool for me, but I want something that's just plain cool.
I agree. I love it, Jerry. All right, we're going to end it there because we have another podcast to record, And it's a very special one that's going to coincide with a particular phone release next week that I think you might be interested in. So we're going to get on with it. We're going to do our weekly What's Making Us Happy, though. So, Ara, we'll start with you because I'm curious. What's making you happy this week?
Well, you're having me... I'm reviewing the Pixel Buds, and whenever they first came out last year? It was last year, right?
Yes. Last year was two years ago, but yes.
Time has no meaning.
Time has no meaning. Anywho, whenever these first came out, I still was just like, those look really, really cool and they could be really, really fun, but earbuds just don't fit me, man. But I've tried. I have worn wireless earbuds to the parks. I've actually worn wireless earbuds on a roller coaster now because the, I don't know who sent me them, but some Tautronics showed up over Christmas. And I finally got around to trying them this last month. And they actually stay in my ears on roller coasters, which is nice. I am not going to try that on Pixel Buds until the review is completely finished being written and photographed in case I lose one. But these have been actually really, really nice. I like the gesture controls on them. These are ones where I actually don't feel like I'm having to consciously think every single time, okay, how do I do the volume versus doing a track? It's not a matter of long pressing it for, like, you gesture forward and back for the volume, and then it's tap for pause, double tap for next track, and triple tap for previous track, which makes it easy. But also, just, it has, it's a wireless tracking case, which, hallelujah, thank God, because that just makes it easier to top up. But also, I just treat this case like a Zippo lighter, and I'll just snap it open and closed and open
and
closed.
Still my favorite aspect of that product, to be honest. The case is incredible.
I can't get past wearing headphones on a roller coaster because...
Do you know how loud Big Thunder Mountain is?
Yeah, but I can just, you know, a bag of mushrooms, your headphones, Space Mountain...
No.
I'd never get out of line.
That's our show. Thank you so much for listening.
Sorry.
Jerry, besides a bag of mushrooms, what's making you happy this week?
I got vaccinated.
Yeah, buddy.
I can leave the house, and when I see you, I'm going to kiss you.
No, you won't. But I will accept. Yeah, yeah, I will accept it. I will kiss you back once I'm vaccinated. But I guess that does lower the risk for you, which is good.
But of course, you know, I've got to get the second shot next week. But
is it next week already? I thought it was a three. You got the Pfizer.
Like,
you got the Pfizer, not the Moderna.
Well, you're right. It's 2 weeks. It's the sixth. Time has no meaning. I already said that.
Yeah. But
you know what? When I know most people listening in the States probably haven't been vaccinated yet. Pay heed to the warnings they give you. I didn't. And yeah, I had a terrible headache for 2 days and felt like I had the flu and my stomach hurt. And, you know, they tell you up front that there could be some side effects, and listen to them. Don't be like me thinking, that ain't going to happen, because it might. Now, my wife, we both got vaccinated at the same time. Nothing. She just would look at me and just shake her head and walk away whenever I'd say, my head hurts. So it is possible, but it's well worth it.
But please, for the love of God, get vaccinated as quickly as you can.
Yep.
Where you can, because in Canada, they're kind of shitting the bed on that.
I heard starting Monday, though, everybody over, 55?
75. They're not even close to 55 years old yet. But we're getting there, so I'm happy. At least my wife's dad will be able to get vaccinated, which is a big deal because he is at a very high risk, so I'm extremely excited for him to be able to hug his granddaughter for the first time in over a year. And then eventually it'll go down to 70, and that'll mean my mom and my mother-in-law. So I'm just excited for my daughter to hug her grandparents again. And that's really all I care about at this point.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Harish, what's making you happy this week?
Waiting to get a vaccination slot. It's not as crazy as Canada in India, thankfully. So we should have a slot for me and my wife sometime at the end of the month. So looking forward to that, because we haven't left the house in a year other than to go see my parents. And yeah, just it'll be interesting to just go outside and do regular things.
Amen, brother. Well, mine is not vaccine related because I have no prospect of getting mine before July 1st. So I'm actually going to talk about a video game again. This week, the Bethesda, so many Bethesda games were added to Xbox Game Pass. It was incredible. I was implored months ago to buy Dishonored, and I didn't because I just didn't want to spend the money. I was expecting it to eventually come to Xbox Game Pass. It did. It also got a FPS boost to 60 frames per second. I've been playing Dishonored on my Series X. It is amazing, especially for a game released 9 years ago. It just feels so solid and really innovative, and I'm having a ton of fun with it. And then I will play Prey after that. And I watched the Digital Foundry like look back at how the games have aged since they were released. So they did one this week looking at the performance, the boost, but also the loading times and how long the loading times were in both Dishonored on Xbox and PS3. So this was an Xbox 360 and PS3 release, and you would wait like 40 seconds for a new area to load, whereas now it's like a second and a half, and I honestly cannot believe that people just withstood those loading times, but I'm very happy I get to play this version. So yeah, I love this game, and I'm really enjoying it. So that is Dishonored on Game Pass. All right, that's it. We will be back very, very soon with another episode. If you have any comments or feedback for this episode, let us know at podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. Ara is at Ara Wagco. Jerry is at GB Hill. Harish is at Chunky Nerd. I am at Journey Dan. We are all at Android Central. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back very soon. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.